Good evening, everybody. I'm Gene Russell, recovered alcoholic. It's really good to be here tonight. It's good to be sober. Who's glad to make it through the holidays, get back to a regular life, huh?
Yeah.
Right on. Give yourselves a hand. You guys, your first holiday coming through, getting sober, congratulations. That's a big deal. I came to see my friend speak tonight and then was asked to introduce him. And if I have to close my eyes and think about one word to describe tonight's speaker, and the word that comes in my mind is humility. What an honor to have a friend like tonight's speaker. A lot of people might attach what he does for a profession as something for a reason to come see him. What binds us together and what you'll hear through his talk tonight is that harmonious way that we get through our problems is what makes us kinfolk. And there's something else that'll go with it, too. I don't want to give any part of any story away, but everybody in this room has some God-inspired art inside of them, and this guy has the courage to go all over the place, all over the world, and let his art show, and it's wonderful. And with great humility and friendship, I'd like to bring to the podium my friend Tinsley.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, big book fell down. All right, and my sobriety date is May 3rd, 1999, and my home group is Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at NABA, and that's Monday night at 8 p.m. Come see us sometime. Usually I open with a joke, but... Some of y'all have heard me speak so many times, and I've only got two jokes, and one of them stinks, and the other one sucks. So I'm not going to tell those, but I will tell you that it is great to be here tonight, and what a great day to be clean and sober, huh? Since I started this journey in recovery, stopped drinking and drugging, I have never once woke up in the morning and said, "Damn, I wish I had drank last night." Just have not had that feeling, not once. Don't miss it. Don't even think about it. So anyway, my story starts in 1957, born at Piedmont Hospital here in Atlanta. I am 57 years old. I like to tell my age right off the bat, because if you're anything like me, you'll sit there and wonder how old the speaker is. And so I'm 57, which means I can order off the senior menu at Denny's. They got some pretty good stuff on there, actually. But something to look forward to for some of y'all. Anyway, my parents were Emory students, and my dad was in law school there. My mom was undergrad, 1957, and had a really good upbringing. If I had to classify my upbringing, I would say it was of the silver spoon variety. And meaning I got everything I wanted. My dad was an attorney. He worked for his dad, who is a longtime attorney in South Florida. And got everything I wanted. The best summer camps and private school. And I went to one of those private schools where you dress not unlike I'm dressed tonight, actually, with a coat and a tie on, and we had a little school patch on the jacket, and a favorite attire of teenagers everywhere, right? Well, not really. So I always kind of felt out because my friends went to the public school, and I would get off the bus, dressed like Angus Young, and not years before he even came on the scene, so it wasn't even hip. And then, extra bonus, during the warm summer months in South Florida, we wore the coat and tie and short pants. So, wow, nerd alert, right? Anyway, and in addition to that nerdy outfit, I was the president of the Glee Club. Okay, not very cool in high school, right? Not even cool to be in the Glee Club in high school, let alone be the president of it. But what was really cool is I met another alcoholic one time, and after I told my story, he said, "Well, if it makes you feel any better, I was the president of the library club." And I thought, well, actually, that does make me feel quite a bit better. But I was, a pretty damn nerdy guy, and so nothing's changed much. And life was good, and I had everything. I was very bratty, and got a car at 16, and all that good stuff, and my grades were really, really good until, right? And then, you know, I just can remember, you know, just feeling, I didn't even feel like I was on the outside looking in. I felt like I was on the outside looking out, right? And so the inevitable happened. I went to a teenage party when I was 15 and had a beer. And wow, brother, I felt like I had arrived. And I hear a lot of people say that, you know, and I don't know that if you're a non-alcoholic where your first beer, I don't know if it's quite a banner day like it was for me, but I can remember everything about it. Remember the height of it. I can remember the brand. I can remember it was a malt liquor, which I didn't know any different, right? So I thought that was great. But I didn't really like the taste of it. I just liked the way I felt. And I was goofy and I was funny, and all of a sudden I wasn't a kid with the, you know, the coat and tie on anymore. And I really liked it. I really liked it. And I went home and thought about it. And then the next weekend I went out and got shit-faced. It took me that quick. There was no such thing. I've never really done anything I liked in moderation. I mean, the only thing that an alcoholic does in moderation is the steps, maybe. But but really, you know, I liked it. And of course, the grades went down. And then, you know, then I did, I said, I'm just gonna drink. I'm not going to do drugs, because drugs are bad. Drinking's good. Drugs are bad. On a Tuesday, I smoked my first joint. On that Saturday, I took my first hit of LSD. Yeah. So I went for it, right? Yeah. You know, right on down the tubes really fast. That's how I do things. But anyway, yeah, and that was the high school experience. And around the same time, well, even backing up a little bit, I had seen the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I don't see too many people in the room that are old enough to remember seeing that, except when it was a rerun. But the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan's show, and it was big, brother. And they were up there, and they were singing, and they were shaking their hair, and my parents were frowning, so that made me want to turn the TV up. And, boy, they were doing it. And I got into the music thing when I was 7 years old. And I really liked that. And but, you know, it really doesn't matter what your job is. If you got this disease, it doesn't matter if you have a job at all. And a lot of people don't when they come in. But, you know, if you were going to be an alcoholic and you were going to pick a job, the music business, I mean, that's a perfect fit right there, because it's really hard to fuck up. But I tried. I really tried. There's only two rules in the music business when it comes to that sort of thing. Rule one, no drinking during the gospel numbers. All right, that's pretty obvious. Rule two, no gospel numbers. So, you know, so pretty much, you know, you can do whatever you want to do, and I did. And because I really felt like at the time, the whole drug culture and stuff, you know, you talk about, you know, Jimi Hendrix, he did a whole bunch of drugs, so that must have been what made him a great musician, right? Or any other number of people you can name. Of course, it killed most of the people that I thought that about, but that didn't stop me, because it was going to be different for me. But, you know, this, I love this book. It's like it was written right for me. And on page 2 of this book, Bill Wilson is talking about just what I'm talking about here. And he says that he's talking to his wife, and he says, although my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Big lie there, right? Big lie. Because what made people like Ernest Hemingway a great writer, he had a gift from God. It didn't come from the bottle. And what made Jimi Hendrix play the hell out of a guitar, that was a gift from God. It didn't come from a baggie or a bottle. But I bought into the big lie. And I felt like, you know, if I'm going to get into it, I better get out of it. And that's really what I went for. I went in totally into the drug culture and the alcohol culture, which I mean, I'm sorry, I hope my drug talk doesn't offend anybody in here, but to me, it's all the same shit, right? You know, I want to get out of it. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to do whatever is there. And so I went off to college here. I went to Emory at Oxford, which was out in the woods, out in Covington, Georgia. And that's where I really honed my drinking skills. And it was a gas. It was 1975, and the dean of students, this guy had to be like 120 years old. This guy was ancient. He didn't know what the hell was going on. And we had a keg party there every single night. And I, you know, it wasn't enough for me just to attend the keg party. I had to go be the guy that, like, picked the keg up and attached the thing to it and took the keg back the next day. And it was really, it became like a way of life for me, the whole get drunk every night kind of thing. And it was fun for a while. I'll admit it. Drinking was fun for a while. I never knew that I could come into an AA meeting and even say that. I thought it was something I needed to be ashamed of, but it was fun for a while. I let drugs and alcohol into my life as an invited guest. Then they turned into a constant companion. And then they turned into a controller. And then they turned into a ruler. And then they turned into a tyrant. And nothing I could do could get them to turn back to any of those other things. You know, certainly not constant companion or friend or anything like that. So there was a time when it was fun. And I can remember, we like to talk about our escapades in here, and I'll tell one of mine. It was in high school, you know, when I was making the transition from head nerd to party animal, which was a pretty quick transition, I might add. I went to a party, and it sounds crazy when I say it, but I shot a bottle rocket out of my ass at a party. And on Monday at school, and there was a lot of alcohol involved in that too, but on Monday at school, guess what everybody was talking about? They were talking about the guy that shot the bottle rocket out of his ass at the party. And I like that. I like attention. I'd chair every meeting if y'all would let me. Please let me. But and so it was fun for a while. It was fun until it wasn't. So I went from college, and I graduated over here at Emory, and instead of going to law school into my dad and grandfather's practice, I went on the road in a rock band, which, wow, that really didn't go over very well. But I did it, and I really liked it. It was wide open. And these guys were a lot older than me, too, and they really corrupted me like I needed any help. But they really did. And then the consequences started happening. When I was 23 years old, I was hospitalized with a bleeding, perforated ulcer, which, you know, it's pretty serious. And that was only a few years after, you know, starting to drink. And so I really ate a hole in my stomach, and my parents I was on the road in Richmond, Virginia, and they put me in the hospital, and I just about bled to death. And they came up there and rescued me. No health insurance. Sorry, Mom and Dad. But I can remember the doctor. My parents were in the room, and they were releasing me after 5 days hooked up to machines, and the doctor was reading this chart, and he said, young Mr. Ellis appears to be nothing more than a binge drinker. And I went, yes, I'm not an alcoholic. They got a name for what I am. I'm a binge drinker. But guess what? The binge is, you know, a binge means you drink for a while and then you don't drink. It was continual for me. And I did that, and I got married. And my college girlfriend, and that didn't work out at all, you know, the lifestyle, but, it was rough, and, both of us were just wide open, and, you know, it was 1981, so give us a break, right? I mean, it was a pretty wild time, but, that was rough, and we ended up getting divorced, and like a month after she got divorced, her boyfriend blew her brains out and killed himself. And so I had all this guilt and all these feelings about it. And I think at that point is when I turned the corner with my drinking. I just started just drinking just to for oblivion at that point. I mean, just to blot out that. I was so confused with, what am I? Am I a widower? Or am I, what am I exactly with? And I loved her, but she was gone, and she was gone twice. I lost her twice, you know, once through the divorce and once for her getting killed. And I could just remember feeling like a real victim for a really long time about it. And I didn't have the tools that we have in here, so what did I do? I just blotted it out the best I could, you know. Nowadays, I want my pain straight up, just like I wanted my liquor. I want my pain straight up. Give it to me. What do you got? I'm going to process it using the tools of this program, and I'm going to get through it. So the consequences were happening, and, you know, I didn't get in trouble every time I drank or drugged, but every time I was in trouble, drugs and alcohol played a part in it in my life. But I couldn't connect the two parts of step one. I just couldn't connect them because I was doing pretty damn good in my business. I admitted I was powerless, but or I felt like my life's falling apart, but it has nothing to do with my drinking. I couldn't connect those two things. I was unwilling to. There was just so much denial involved. And I remember that... It, you know, I stopped. I started getting that feeling that, you know, here I go again. And I started trying to cut down on my drinking. And I just couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. I would, I'd never swore off with a solemn oath or anything, but I had plenty of New Year's resolutions that would be gone by about, 7 o'clock at night on the January 1st. So I'm not sure if that even qualifies as a resolution, but I just couldn't find a way to have any fun with it, and I couldn't find a way to stop, and I couldn't find any way to cut back. And I noticed even in college that my friends would drink, and they would get pretty drunk, and then they would do something very strange. They would pile into a car and go to the Waffle House and eat. Well, that was unthinkable to me. I mean, eating, what's eating got to do with this? I want to go for it. And I noticed that once I started, I couldn't stop. I didn't know that was one of the qualifications for being an alcoholic, but I certainly could relate to it when y'all talked about it, because you knew what it felt like to be like that. I just knew that I was different than my friends who were growing up and getting a life, some of them having successful relationships, and maybe every once in a while they'd get together and tie one on. Well, I was doing it night after night after night after night after night, and it sucked, and I hated myself, and I couldn't stop. So by the time I found the rooms of AA, I was 33 years old. It was 1990. And by the time I came to my first AA meeting, everybody thought it was a good idea. Even the dope man thought it was a good idea. And he came to a couple of meetings with me, and I haven't seen him in a really long time, but even he thought it was a good idea, because I was a total asshole when I drank, especially drinking. I mean, drugs may be weird, but drinking may be just really mean. And and so I came and I listened and I got this soft cover book, because I didn't really feel like I had hardcover recovery in me. So I got the soft cover book and I said, oh, this is great. This is going to be good. And then I went back on the road, and for the next 8.5 years, it was a sea of half measures, an ocean of half measures. And I was adrift on the ocean of half measures. And I tried every twist of this program that I could give, you know. I really thought that half measures would avail me at least half. But what do they avail me? Half measures avail me nothing. Nada. Zilch. Nil. I love that word, nil. And it just, I'm not sure which was worse. You know, having gone to a bunch of AA meetings to still be using, or having not gone at all. All I remember is that there was shame involved. It used to just suck, but now it sucked and I was ashamed. So I kept piling on these horrible feelings on top of what I was doing, and I would switch from, okay, I'm going to just take pills instead of drinking. Well, that's like changing seats on the Titanic. You know, the ship is going down, and I'm looking for a better deck chair. And and that didn't work. And I remember I've heard of the marijuana maintenance program. I certainly tried that, but I tried the cocaine maintenance program, which made me, without alcohol, made me a very, very nervous person. And I remember somebody coming up to me and said, "You look so concerned." And I thought, "Yeah, well, I'm on edge, and not sleeping too well. Clothes fit well, but not sleeping too well." But and I remember, you know, and it just sucked. And I just tried everything I could, and then it just about killed me. And I came back in 1999, and my ass was completely whooped. And I came back in, and I knew what I needed to do. What I needed to do was all the stuff that I hadn't done before, because I was just hanging around, you know, like it was gonna, like this thing was gonna rub off on me somehow. And this thing doesn't rub off on, you know, that's not how this works. It's a process. And I know that when I came back in 1999, I came in with a different attitude. I arrived in tears, and I think that it helps to arrive in tears. You have that gift of desperation. The book talks about it. It says, who is willing to do these things? You know, to the steps they're talking about, or getting a sponsor, go to all these meetings, or do this service work, praying to a God we don't understand. Who's willing to do that? Well, the person who's willing to do that is the person who has to do those things in order to stay alive. Because when I tried to even do any of those things just to cut back or stop, that wasn't enough of an incentive. I had to do this thing to stay alive. And I have to remember that, too, that this is a disease that will kill me dead. How many times do I have to see it before I understand? So I have to remember that, and the meetings helped me remember that. Now, when I came in, I remember it was at a clubhouse upstairs on Beaufort Highway called the Log Cabin Group. And Alonzo was there that night. He saw me. And was so friendly, and I appreciate that very much. But I still keep in contact with a lot of the people at that meeting. And I got a sponsor. And this man took me outside. He wasn't my sponsor yet, but he and I were talking outside. And one thing I noticed about him is he lit his cigarettes off of his cigarettes. And I thought, that's really hardcore. I like this guy, you know. He's like, get one going and get the other one going. And, boy, he'd be so embarrassed if he was here tonight hearing me say that. But he did. And we talked. And he talked to me like no other man had ever talked to me before. Because I'd been yelled at, I'd been fired, I'd been hooked up to machines and prayed over, and I got a checkup from the neck up, and I got yelled at some more, and I got divorced. And those people all said, you know, you ought to cut back on your drinking, you know. But that didn't do anything. That didn't even give me a mental defense. That just went in one ear and out the other. But this man talked to me like no man had ever talked to me before. And it was a very spiritual feeling. I didn't know it was spiritual at the time, but looking back at it, I can see that it was certainly different. And I can remember him saying stuff to me like, if you want what I have, do what I did. And I was kind of curious to know what he had done. And he talked about keeping it simple. In fact, he told me that if I did five things, I would stand a great chance of staying clean and sober. And I was interested to hear about what those five things were. He said, go to a ton of meetings, get a competent sponsor of your own gender, learn to pray, work all 12 steps in order, and help others, work with others. That seemed like a pretty simple program. Of course, this is a simple program, but it's not easy. It's not easy because it involves work, and work's not fun. If work was fun, they'd call it going to fun in the morning, but they don't. You know, it's just kind of a hassle. But if I think about what goes on, and when I was out there drinking and using, it was a teeny bit of pleasure followed by a whole bunch of pain. If I think about what goes on in recovery, it's a teeny bit of discomfort followed by a lifetime of pleasure. Right? I just didn't know it would be like that. I didn't know what y'all were going to ask me to do. I was terrified about it. And I couldn't get sober until the fear of my disease was larger than the fear of its solution. So in other words, when I showed up in tears, that's when I became willing, or as step six says, entirely ready to do this program. So he gave me those suggestions, and the first thing he suggests is that I go to a ton of meetings. Well, I'm a busy guy, you know. I don't have time for all these meetings. But really I do, okay, let's face it, I do. My job is like 1.5 hours a day, and the rest of the time is like worrying about my job. So I've got time for a meeting. I go every day. If I travel, I love to go. I love to go to meetings where I don't know a single person. That turns me on. I don't know why, but I'll tell you this, an AA meeting is the only place on earth where a group of strangers can get together and reminisce. I know of no other place on earth where that happens. And I love that. I love going in there. And I'll just tell one funny story about that. I was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and you know, you introduce yourself as a visitor. I'm Tinsley, I'm an alcoholic, I'm visiting from Atlanta. So I introduce myself, and the guy next to me says, "I know who you are." So the whole meeting, I'm pumped up, you know. I'm thinking, I'm going to talk to this guy. He knows who I am. He knows what I do. So after the meeting, you know, the meeting ended, and he turned to me and said, yeah, it's good to see you here. He goes, I heard you tell your story at the 12-Step Titans. This was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And this guy, he wasn't talking about a job that I have or anything like that. He was talking about, he heard me tell my story. That felt pretty good. You can't orchestrate something like that. And that certainly gives me a lot more comfort than any drug or a drink would ever give me, a feeling like I fit in. The meetings are so important. I hear stuff at meetings that I need to hear. You know, it's terrible when I go to a meeting and somebody comes in after 15 years and picks up a white chip. I hate to see that, but I need to see that. Because I know that when people come back in, I've noticed they usually say, well, I slacked off on my meetings. And I don't want that to happen to me. I really don't. I don't want it to happen to anybody, actually. But I've noticed that the meetings, I try not to miss meetings, because the more I miss meetings, the more I miss drugs and alcohol. And I don't need to miss them at all. He recommended I get a home group. I think that's a real important thing. I have one. I really enjoy it because they don't have group consciences, and I like that. We get together and discuss some stuff, but it's not heavy. It's pretty light. And going to meetings is just how I change the way I feel, and that's all I wanted out of drugs and alcohol anyway. If things were bad, I wanted them to be good. If they were good, I wanted them to be better. If nothing was going on at all, I wanted some, you know, activity, some gusto. And that's why I drank. And the meetings give me all those things. It's a sense of relief, ease, and comfort, like they talk about in the doctor's opinion. Second thing he recommended was that I get a sponsor of my own gender. And he appointed himself as my sponsor, and if y'all know him, you could see how that could happen. And I'm glad he did that, because I was so vain that I don't know that I would have asked him or anybody else. And maybe I've heard that they do that. They did that in the old days. People would appoint themselves or something like that. But that's what he did to me, and he rode me hard. But he was so nice at first, and then he started telling me stuff about myself. I remember it was like maybe the third time we got together, and he said, I was bitching about something, and he said, he started saying stuff like, well, your problems are of your own making. And then he had another one that I hated, which was you're exactly where you're supposed to be right now. I hated that one. So he started telling me some stuff I didn't want to hear. And for the first time in my life, I sat there and took it. Whereas before, I would have said, okay, and then I would change my phone number or something like that. But I sat there and I took it because I had that gift of desperation. And my sponsor is not my banker, and he's not my ride or, you know, marriage counselor or psychiatrist or anything like that. But he's put me in touch with some people that have helped me in other areas of my life. And his job was as sponsor, and when I sponsor gentlemen, my job is to take them through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why would somebody come to a 12-step program and not work the 12 steps? I'm not sure. But a lot of people try to do it, and I know I certainly try to do it, and I couldn't stay clean and sober. So that's why the steps have been so important to me. But, you know, he took me through those steps, and we sat one-on-one and went through them, and he took a lot of time for me. And I know that I know why he did that, and I know why I do that. It's for a number of reasons. It you know, it helps me. It helps them. Everybody's happy that I'm sober still. And, you know, I know that in step one, like I said earlier, you know, I could admit that I was powerless, but I could not admit that the unmanageability in my life had anything to do with my drinking and drugging. I couldn't see the tie-in between that because I was always saying, well, this happened, you know, these are separate things. And there's so much denial involved, at least with me, there was so much denial involved when I was drinking. And I protected my disease very well with rationalization, you know. When I ended up in the hospital, it was the quality of the substances. It wasn't the amount that I was taking, stuff like that. And one of my favorite stories about denial is a friend of mine. He was drinking, he was drinking a couple of quarts of liquor a day, which sounds disgusting to me right now. Wow. But he was drinking it, and he was drinking to live. That's what he did. And his friends, his high school friends, went over, and they tried like an intervention or something, and they're talking to him. And they said, now, we know you love to drink. Why don't you have a drink of liquor and then have a glass of water? And then a drink, and then you can have another drink of liquor, and then a glass of water, because you love to drink. So, and then he got, my friend said, man, we don't know what the government's putting in that water. And, man, that's some serious denial right there. And unfortunately, it killed him. But he was protecting his disease, and I certainly did that. So step one was something that I had a rough go with in the beginning. Thought I could put you know, a twist to it, but how many times do we have to hear that step one is we have to be thoroughly convinced, and then we do the other stuff when we become thoroughly convinced. So when I came in, I was thoroughly convinced that I was powerless over every substance that's mind altering, and that my life had become unmanageable, which it certainly was at the time. And but then we got to step two. The God stuff. You know, I didn't believe in God when I came in, and I was mad at God. Now, that's pretty crazy. I was mad at something I didn't believe in, but that's the way I felt about it. I just didn't see the tie-in between what does God have to do with my drinking problem? And so I tried AA without seeking a higher power, and I couldn't stay clean and sober, and that's what it had to do with my drinking problem. I've got a powerful disease, and I need a powerful solution. I need a higher power. I need something stronger than alcohol, which means it's got to be really strong, you know, if it's going to be stronger than alcohol. But I know that I had any number of reasons why the God thing was bad. When I was in elementary school, and like I said earlier, I was very churchy and nerdy, and I went to church every Sunday with my family. And I remember we all came out of church, and we were in the church parking lot, and an elderly usher there was the usher at the church, helped people get seated. He lost control of his car and ran over an old lady in the parking lot and killed her in front of the whole congregation. Now, you're telling me that that God is going to get me sober? No way. Why would he let that happen? And I carried that story with me for a really long time. And my disease helped out. My disease said, remember that story? Remember what happened to that lady in the church parking lot? It was a horrible sight, too. It was really bad and sad. And you know what? That usher came back the next Sunday to church. Now, there's a strong faith for you right there. Right? Okay, well, anyway, it wasn't until step two, going over that with my sponsor, that I was able to even crack the door open at all to the notion that a higher power could help me. There's a sentence in the 12 and 12. I love it. It saved my ass. And it says, you can, if you like, even make AA itself your higher power. It says so right in the book. I'll show it to you if you don't believe me. It's in there. And I did that because I could see how 35 people with a desire and a plan to stay sober, greater than one person's plan. 35 is greater than one. 35 is a higher power than one. I had to take it that piecemeal right there. That's the only thing that made any sense to me at all, because it just did. And then another guy at a meeting one time shared his version of a higher power. And it's just any program that says you can come up with your own version of a higher power. Now that's the program for me right there, because I don't want to be told what God is, especially if I can't see him or it or her, whatever. But people share their own version of it. This guy said he had been in the military, and he was a terrible runner. He couldn't run a quarter mile. But when he got with a group of men in the military, he found it very easy to run along with the group of people. Not just because he was made to do that, not because he was in better shape. He just felt like he was tapped into something larger than himself. And I love that explanation of it. We come up with our own higher power. It's got to be something stronger than the booze and the drugs. It's got to be. And that's what I found in here. Now, in step three, because I was seeing AA as my higher power, what I did was I turned my life and my will and my way of living over to the care and protection of the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The rest of the steps. I remember my sponsor had me kneel down and say the third step prayer with him. And he had the book, and we were there, and he goes, all right, we're going to kneel down right now, and you're going to put your arm around me, I'm going to put my arm around you, and we're going to say the third step prayer. And I was like, huh? What in the world has this got to do with my drink and drug problem? But you know what? I could remember with sufficient force the pain and suffering of my last buzz and how it sucked so bad. I didn't just get up and leave. I knew it was the door or the floor, and I chose the floor. I knelt down and prayed with him. And in the old days of AA, they used to call that making a surrender. And they'd have, back then, they probably used more classical spiritual literature, i.e. the Bible, and they would pray with somebody, and invariably one or two things would happen. The guy would say, and leave, or he would kneel down and pray. Because it's just representing something I had never done before. And recovery is all about me doing something I've never done before. And to stay clean and sober and to live a better life and to not be miserable all the time. Now, in step four, I really didn't want to do a fourth step. I mean, who does, right? Unless it's a fourth step of somebody, another person, we like to do that. But a fourth step of myself, I didn't want to do that. And I dragged my feet. I dragged my feet on it, and I said, I don't have a good time. I'm a busy man. I don't have a good time to start. And I remember I was told, well, let me suggest a good time to start. A good time to start your fourth step is when you're ready to be clean and sober. Wow. Okay, well, I better do it then, because I was ready. And I did it, and I made a list of all the things about how I am, not who I am, but all the stuff about how I am. And it just happened to be a list of the stuff that kept me thirsty all the time. The the fears, the resentments, the unmade amends, the harms, all of this stuff about me that made me just, it just was eating my lunch inside, and I just wanted to blot it out. And those are the very things that will take me back out if I don't watch it. And thank God for this program, because I never knew I was such a fearful person. Never knew that at all. And then I sat down with my sponsor and told him all these things and all this stuff that I said I was never going to tell anybody. And that was a real freeing experience for me. Yet again, something I never planned to do. That was not a part of my plan to stay sober, was just sit there and tell on myself. You know, and I remember nothing I told him shocked him. And I also remember he pointed out that I had some good stuff going on too about me, which I liked a lot. And you know, neither better or no worse than anybody else. And that was nice. It was a nice feeling to free myself of that stuff. And then step six. You know, these are the short six and seven, the shortest paragraphs in the big book, or the shortest steps in the big book. I think it's only three paragraphs. And but I've learned over time, and I've heard old timers share, this is the meat of this program. What good does it do for me to make a list of all these things that keep me thirsty and make me an asshole? What good does it do to make that list, tell somebody about them, and then just hold on to them and not change? Change is so important. If I was the same person I was when I first came in and picked up my white chips, if I was that same person, I'd still be drinking and drugging. I'm convinced of it. A person as fearful and angry as me, it's an alcoholic, is going to drink again. And the steps six and seven have helped me so much. Now, I'm not perfect. I'll admit that. I have my moments, but I'm making some progress, and I have, you know, people who call me out on my shit. I have a lot of them. Too many of them, actually. But I hear the voice in my head, my higher power will, you know, let me know. And so I know now, with alcohol in me and drugs in me, I don't even listen to that voice. I don't even sure if I hear it. But you know, these six and sevens, all about the change. How sober do I want to be, right? That's what the question six and seven asks. Because I know that steps one, two, and three got me sober. Steps 10, 11, 12 keep me sober. And the middle steps, 4 through 9, deal with the quality of my sobriety. How sober do I want to be? How happy do I want to be? Answer, pretty damn happy. So steps 8 and 9 go together. Step 8 was pretty damn easy because I just wrote down everybody I could think of, because that's who, you know, I owed an amends to. My drinking and drugging had taken me to that level where, you know, I owed everybody an amends, including myself. And then step 9, I just did it. You know, the reason I never did any stuff like that before is because I was a coward, and that fear played a part in it. It's so good that they put step 9 where they put it instead of right after step 1, because, you know, you get sober one day and then the next day you're going to make all these amends. I don't think so. I think you're going to have to get right sized. I'm not sure how long the time period is, but not right away probably. I could really see a tie-in between step 9 and staying sober, because I was the type of drunk that would I would have to get drunk before I went out to get drunk, because I was going to run into somebody, you know, that I owed money to or an apology to or insulted. And so it never occurred to me that if I wanted to be sober, that I needed to find a way to face these people and not hide from these people. And I can tell you right now that right now in my life, I ain't mad with anybody, and nobody's mad with me that I know about. That's a pretty good feeling. Now, there are some people in my life that I would deem small dose people. In other words, I can take just a small dose of them, but I'm not mad with them. You know, I can see them and shake their hands. You know, step 10, wow, is there any more beautiful literature in the big book than step 10? I don't think so. Wow, pretty amazing. It's like poetry to me. I could read it over and over again. It never gets old. I'm going to look at these things about myself, and I'm going to continue to use this program and use y'all, and I'm going to be able to go to these places and not even think about drinking or drugging, not be mad at people, you know, not cut people off in traffic and chase them down to the end of the earth to do what, you know? Things like that. I love step 10. Step 11 is more of, you know, we've been praying. By the time we get to step 11, we've been doing a lot of praying. We just keep on praying. To what? I'm not sure, but I do it and it works. And, you know, I started off with the group as my higher power, and now it's something else. And I'm not sure what it is, but there's definitely something working in these rooms. My uncle died, and I went to his funeral, and it was really sad. But at the end of the funeral service, we all stood up and said the Lord's Prayer, and I found myself praying to the same God at that funeral that I pray to in here. I call that progress, you know. I had that same feeling. It felt good. And then step 12, which in my opinion is the key to long-term sobriety, working with others. And I'm going to read, you know, I could talk about it, but it's written so beautifully in Bill's story here on page 15. And those of you who know me know that this is one of my favorite readings in the book. Page 15, Bill Wilson, he doesn't have a home group, and he doesn't go to conventions, and they're not fussing over what to read and what not to read. He's just listening to his higher power, and he says, "My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which time I found little work. I was not too well at the time, and I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment that sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and sit on my feet. It is a design for a living that works in rough going." Amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. That's what I wanted out of drugs and alcohol. I wanted it to make everything better, and it sucked, and it turned on me, and it didn't work anymore, but I didn't have any other tools. Certainly not working with others. That wasn't a part of my plan. What's that got to do with my drinking problem? I didn't know until I tried it. I didn't know that I could reach out to y'all and say, "How you doing?" And that would make everybody feel good and keep me sober. I didn't know that that would work. And it's a very spiritual aspect of this program, I think. It's just an amazing thing. I sponsor people, and I always feel better after getting together with them. I really do. It's an amazing thing. And then it talks about a design for a living that works in rough going, implying that the going is going to get rough. And as we get older, the twists and turns of our life, you know, they just come upon us. And thank God that we have this program and this fellowship to fall back on. We hold each other up in here. We don't pull each other down. And we have sponsors, and we reach out to our sponsor, and they help us see our part in things. It's an amazing program, amazing steps, divinely inspired, in my opinion. And I continue to do what he recommended the first time we got together, and it continues to work for me. And then over time, I find that there's other tools of recovery, like, you know, reading the acceptance page. I remember I was really upset about something, and I read the acceptance page, and I was still upset about something. And then an old-timer said, "Well, have you thought about working a step on it?" And I'm like, "Damn, a step, you're right." So we have the tools of recovery, and then we have the steps, which are part of the tools of recovery. The steps are pretty much, they can address everything in my life. The slogans help me, but sometimes the slogans aren't enough. The slogans are the band-aids. The steps are the medicine, and God is the doctor. And, you know, I need those steps, and I need a higher power in my life to make me feel right and to make me feel comfortable in my own skin. You know, I can remember coming to my very first meeting and thinking, this is the end of fun forever. And I was really convinced of that. I thought, this is it, end of fun forever. And did the walk of shame up there, and I got my white chip. Little did I know, this is the beginning of fun, right? I feel really happy, and I'm not sure if I'm happy because I'm sober or sober because I'm happy, but I'll tell you this, it's not an act. I'm really happy. And have bad moments sometimes, and they pass, and y'all help me get through that. There was a time in early sobriety where I kind of was really cutting back on my meetings. I remember I didn't go for a month at one time, and I was so dry that I was a fire hazard. And I tell you, I was nobody's sweetheart. And went to a meeting, and somebody said, I hadn't seen you in a while. And I was in a real shitty mood. I said, well, the meetings have gotten boring. And y'all have heard me tell this one, but I'll tell it again because it amuses me. But he said, the meetings have gotten boring, huh? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, do you play golf? No, I don't play golf. Play tennis? No, I don't play tennis. Would you go hiking or camping or anything like that? No, I don't do any of those things. The old timer said, do you have any hobbies at all? And I said, not really. And he said, well, AA is not boring. You are. And that's the simple fact of the matter. I associated everything fun in my life with getting wasted. If I was going to a concert, got to bring the right amount of this, that, and the other. If I was going to the ball game, how much are the drinks going to cost? And what time do they, you know, what inning are they going to stop selling? You know, if I'm in a foreign country, I got to learn all their laws about drinking. What a hassle, right? What a hassle. You know, it's like a crappy job you got to go to every day to feed that monster. And now just a total freedom not to have to be ruled by that and to be able to have fun and laughter. The stuff we laugh at in these rooms, oh my God, a normal person would never laugh at the stuff we laugh at. But short of somebody dying, pretty much everything is fair game, right? And so, you know, we laugh because we're relieved. I don't know if y'all have ever been on an airplane and you hit one of those air pockets and the plane dips and everybody screams and then everybody laughs, right? He's done that. And it's a sense of relief. We got through this thing. Now, what is my life like today? It's pretty good at the moment. Like I said earlier, nobody's mad at me and I'm not mad at anybody. That's a change. And, you know, there's some challenges in my life. Things that used to be major hardships in my life are now opportunities or challenges. I have a mentally challenged daughter, and made me real mad at first when that we were given the prognosis of that, and what am I going to do? And I tell you what, I see it as such an opportunity now. And with drugs and alcohol in my system, it would be nothing but a disaster and nothing but sad. And now I see it as an opportunity, and every little thing she does is so beautiful and so wonderful. And I get to do stuff with her that I wouldn't get to do if I was drunk, that's for sure. You know, some people come into the rooms and they have nothing. I came into the rooms and I had a lot of stuff. I'm pretty sure that stuff didn't do me any favors when it came to me getting clean and sober. But I do know that, you know, I'm doing stuff in my career, for instance, that I have never done before. Stuff I used to sit on the bar stool and say I was going to do. I'm going to start my own record company. I'm tired of working for the man. I'm going to have my own recording studio. I'm tired of paying $1,000 a day. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then the next day I wake up and go, oh, my God. You know, and I never did any of the stuff I want to do. I went back and took a course in computer recording, and now I make my own albums. And I'm not saying it to brag, but I'm telling you that it's all a gift of this program. I can't think of anything in my life that AA hasn't helped me with. Every aspect of my life. But more than anything else, the miracle of recovery, to me, you know, the most miraculous thing about this program is not that I don't drink or drug. The most miraculous thing about this program is that I don't want to drink or drug. Thanks for letting me share.